You.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Well, don't be sniffy about
I'm not pens. Being sniffy.
I think I you mean, are.
No, no.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
it's a collective sauna of awe.
Oh, yeah, it still gives me chills. Gives me goosebumps. I love it.
The Eagles suck. What do you think about the Eagles?
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
You might have heard our bit of Studio 360 news. We've just moved our offices and studios to Slate Magazine in Brooklyn, which means I'm excited. We're all excited here about making great news stories and interviews for the radio show and expanding our podcast offerings as well, about meeting our new Slate colleagues and figuring out the best ways for Studio 360 to collaborate and cross-pollinate with them. So as we spend this month settling in, we will be sharing on the show some of our favorite segments from the last couple of years, to introduce ourselves to new listeners who may be finding us through Slate, and to remind you and ourselves of some of the excellent things that can happen when people talk into microphones. Think of this month's shows as a set of Studio 360 chocolate sampler boxes. You bite in and the delicious mystery at our center will be revealed. This week, stories all about music. In the early and mid-1990s, the Pacific Northwest was the epicenter of the American rock music world. Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Slater Kinney. So you want to be an entertainer. The band was great and incredibly influential. Esquire magazine called them the best band ever. I talked to Carrie Brownstein, Slater Kinney's best-known founding member, a couple of years ago. She had just published a memoir about the band's rise and fall and resurrection called Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. For Carrie, it all started at a Madonna concert, and not just any Madonna concert. It was 1985, and Madonna had just exploded, and she was on her Like a Virgin tour.
She started the tour in Seattle, which is where I saw her, and I saw her on the first night. So I was a concert virgin, and she was a virgin of some sort. I was on my feet the entire time. It was the first time I had a sense kind of being taken out of body from music, feeling myself in this environment of fans, and it was very... very exhilarating.
And so it was the communal fan ecstasy as much as the music?
I mean, the music was secondary to just the experience of, you know, looking around and seeing all these other people in various states of crying or screaming, sweating. It's a very sensual physical experience. Yeah. You know, and as a person only in fifth grade, I mean, usually I was just sweating during a soccer game, you know, but to suddenly just be in this sort of like collective sauna of awe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I came home and I could not sleep. I was so excited. And I remember my parents, I went into their room and my dad just laughed and said, "You're high," which I also didn't understand what that meant, you know, because.
Did you understand what like a virgin meant at 10?
Barely.
Yeah.
Barely.
How cute for your parents. You seem this very low-key present person. Seeing you on stage, you rock and you jump and you throw yourself around. Do you feel like a different person when you're behaving in this wild rock and roll star way on stage?
Yeah, I do. And I like the transformative quality and what a stage allows you to do, which one is believing yourself, especially with music that has volume and loudness, as Slater Kinney does, it kind of creates this sort of buffer between your sort of quotidian self and your performer self, and you are just allowed within that sphere to explore. And there's so few real-life pedestrian moments where you're allowed to express anger or even sheer sort of unadulterated joy or danger. I mean, people can't do that. People,
thank goodness.
Yes, it's not appropriate.
You can play a character, but it's a character that is a version of you.
It's, in some ways, it feels like I'm moving closer to a version of myself that has really been the self that has saved me most of the time.
Right. I want to play a Sleater-Kinney song from your seventh album from a decade ago, The Woods. It's called Jumpers. So talk about how that song came to be.
There was a brief period of time when I was living in the Bay Area. I felt very displaced down there. There was such a disparity between these bright, beautiful, cloudless days and this encroaching depression. And as anyone knows that's suffered depression, and that's something that I've suffered with most of my adult life, it creates a colorless world. So, and if you, the more in contrast you feel to your environment, the more pronounced that sense of despair can be. So I was sort of living in this beautiful place and feeling very lost. I was reading an article in The New Yorker by Tad Friend called Jumpers. It was about suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge, and it was a harrowing article. It was about actually the survivors, a very small percentage of people that have survived the attempted suicide off that bridge.
I remember that piece, and I still think about the fact of the survivors who said, as soon as I jumped, I regretted it.
Yes, that's a haunting part of that story. And what I wanted to write about was, you know, this strange, just this combination of something that signifies, you know, architectural prowess and structure and solidity and a symbol of progress in the city, that it could both be that and a place of despair. And the ways that people hope that cannot find meaning in their life, their last hope is that they'll find it in their death. That to me is very sad. And I related to it a lot then.
And 10 years later, do you relate to it in a different way?
You know, when Sleater-Kinney, we went on hiatus for about 10 years. This year, we came back and
that doesn't count as breaking up and coming back together?
Sure. You can,
yeah.
Semantics. We broke up, we went on hiatus. anyway, we weren't playing music together for almost a decade. And when we came back together to start writing No Cities to Love, we started out playing some of our old songs just to reconnect. And I remember we practiced Jumpers. It's one of our favorite songs. And I realized I was singing it about living this time, which is a big change.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think of it differently now.
In the book, you write a lot about this uncomfortable tension mm-hmm. that you and your bandmates had when the first time you were a band together, and that was essential to your sound, as uncomfortable as it was.
Yeah, I think all creative partnerships have a volatility to them by nature, because I can't imagine being in a creative collaboration with someone I agree with all the time.
Sure.
I would just be a solo artist at that point.
And the nature of the music, did that seem like, oh, we should be angry at each other?
No. No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, in fact, when the band is most galvanic is when all cylinders are firing and we are a collective force moving in the same direction. I mean, that is the aspiration. That is the hope. But I think in the process of that, it helps just foster a better song, a more interesting song.
Right.
So we're each adding our ideas. But no, certainly I never liked getting on stage if we were having tension within the band. You can play that out on stage, but that to me is not a drama that I want to witness, and it's not one I want to be a part of, because it shuts off communication. And then often if we started a show like that, which I should say is very rare, we would end the show together.
Yeah. In the book, you talk about the tour in support of the album The Woods that song was that we played before is on, being really tough. You were in a terrible place. And you describe it very starkly and vividly. Do you have a single most vivid memory from that time? I can think of one in the book, and I don't know if that's it, but...
Well, I mean, my body had kind of been rejecting tour for years. Tour is a very fragmentary existence. It's peripatetic. It is destabilizing.
Right.
And so my body had kind of been screaming out for years, like, please stop, please slow down. And in some ways, I felt like I was touring emergency rooms. I felt like I've seen a hospital in so many cities.
Really?
Yeah, Leicester in England, Denver. Seattle.
Because you were just not like bummed out. You were breaking down.
Yeah, I was having panic attacks and back going out. You know, just it kind of all came to a head in Belgium in 2006. And I describe in the book a very self-annihilating moment that unfortunately happened, period, but also happened in front of my bandmates and really...
You punched yourself in the face.
Yeah. I
try to imagine what that means.
It means exactly. I mean,
really, you can really sock yourself.
Yeah, please don't try it. But
don't worry.
You're like, don't worry. I'm not crazy. Well, I'm not crazy either. But I will say that there's an essayist I love, Charles D'Ambrosio. In an interview, he talks about this idea. One reason he writes is sort of the dream of making the distance go away. And I felt like I had really tried so hard to assemble a life, a substitution for family that I didn't feel like I had. But by being detached, I was creating loss and longing. And I think I got to the point where I was a divided self and that I couldn't function like that anymore. And that's what, you know, broke up the band. In retrospect, it was actually a good time to go out. It wasn't a good way to go out, but it was not a bad time.
And then you didn't pick up a guitar or sing, or you just like went cold turkey for a few years.
A few years. I wrote for NPR Music. I did a blog, volunteered at a humane society, worked at an ad agency. I threw myself into a lot of different jobs. Then Janet Weiss, the drummer of Slater Kinney, and I were in a band called Wild Flag. And then I started Portlandia with Fred Armisen.
Which just finished its fifth season, which makes the passage of time seem too fast. Two of my favorite characters on the show work in the feminist bookstore. I want to play a clip. You are Tony, and Fred Armisen is Candace, and her son, played by Bobby Moynihan, comes in with his baby. And for sensitive listeners, warning, they're going to discuss anatomy.
Why don't you get something here in our store for Valerie?
There's nothing here for Valerie.
You want this vagina pillow?
I don't want that vagina pillow. We have so many. We have 13 vagina pillows. My entire bed looks like a bunch of women exploded on it.
That's one room. So there's other rooms in the house that you could...
Just give each other vagina pillows every Christmas?
I don't need a vagina pillow.
No one does.
And especially for the little one.
The little one does not need a vagina pillow. He doesn't need
Bob, we don't want to know the gender of the baby. We don't want to know the sex, and you know that.
I don't know your gender. I don't know Candace's. I don't know mine.
You don't know my gender?
I don't.
Do I look like a woman?
I don't know what a woman looks like.
That is from the third season of Portlandia. Knowing who you are, now having read this book, you clearly have fondness for that subculture and these subcultures that you're satirizing and parodying, but you're pretty effectively and some might think viciously satirizing them. Is the kind of sort of self-regard and jargon and all that stuff that we heard in that bit, is that endemic to progressives, to humans in any little world? What's your take on that?
I mean, if we are hyper concerned about, you know, organic versus local, or, you know, how our coffee's made, like, but the certain kind of worries are just a privilege. You know, sometimes right. I think that narcissism of small things can start to be corrosive, and you think, huh, I wonder if we're heading in the right direction with this preciousness. And I think Portlandia, we're not sitting outside of it looking in. We're right. very much engaged
right.
in
right.
it.
Right.
And so I think we're trying to be part of an ongoing conversation that's already happening, where people are wondering, huh, these sort of highly curated selves that we're projecting, these highly
yes.
curated neighborhoods
yes.
that are just reflections of our highly curated selves, is this making us better people? I think some of us are wondering whether maybe that's not so true anymore. And that's essentially what Portland is about.
Well said. For, you know, the kind of rock and roller that you were and are, the serious indie edgy person, to go to satirical comedy improv, I know both kinds of people, and I've never met one who seemed remotely like the other. Do you know?
Yeah, I think the common through line is observation, is analysis, is a desire to connect. In some ways, Portlandia, when I talk about immersing myself in a very earnest world of music, and one that I'm very protective of and feel and take very seriously, and the kind of music I play, there's a darkness to it that is intense. And I think Portlandia in some ways has allowed an unmasking, a levity that I think I really require
yeah.
and appreciate. So to me, they complement each other.
I can see that.
And so, yeah.
Because they are not adjacent.
It's yes.
not like, oh, I'm doing this different kind of music now.
Exactly. Yeah.
How does TV fandom feel compared to rock star fandom?
Yeah, that's a good question. One time I was at an airport in San Francisco, and earlier this year, season 5 of Portlandia premiered within a week of Slater Kinney's new album, No Cities to Love, coming out. And I was having, sitting down, having a drink before my flight. A couple to the right of me said, "Hey, we love Portlandia. Can we get your picture?" And I said, "Sure, no problem." And then another couple came up to me on my left, and they glared at the other couple, and they said, "We don't know your show, but we have been fans of your band for a very long time, and we don't need your picture."
that's like, we should have that on tape.
It was beautiful, and I loved both couples.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Final question. So what song should we play as we end this thing? It can either be one of your songs. It can be any song you wish.
You know what? Let's play something from the new Joanna Newsom album, Divers. What a gift to this world Joanna Newsom is. Let's play track number 2 from her new album, Divers.
You sound like an NPR record anchor.
I'm not bad at it.
Carrie Brownstein, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
I talked with Carrie Brownstein in 2015. The 8th and final season of Portlandia will air next year. Coming up,
there's still something in common with the kind of repetitive, almost this taffy is, you know, pulling slowly and this kind of musical goo in a way, and I don't mean that in any derogatory way.
The glorious and gooey music of Twin Peaks. That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI in association with Slate. This month, we're settling into new offices and new studios with our new colleagues at Slate Magazine. Slate makes some of my favorite podcasts, such as Trumpcast, on which I've been a guest. It's a show about our unlikely president that usually begins with an actor reading some of POTUS's actual recent tweets.
"I heard poorly rated Morning Joe speaks badly of me don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ crazy Micah along with Psycho Joe came to Mar-a-Lago 3 nights in a row around New Year's Eve?
That's John DiDomenico reading real tweets as President Trump on Slate's TrumpCast. So as we unpack and settle in this month with Slate, we wanted to share with you some of our favorite Studio 360 segments from the last couple of years. This week, it's all about music. When David Lynch's Twin Peaks was getting its reboot on Showtime this last spring, we did a Studio 360 hour on what made the original show so great in the early 90s and so influential ever since. One of those defining characters was the score by Angelo Badalamenti.
David would sit right over here, right to the right of me, and we would put a little cassette just about over here on this keyboard.
In the documentary Secrets from Another Place, Badalamenti describes how Lynch finessed him into musicalizing some of the show's major themes without showing him any footage. You know,
just get me into that beautiful darkness with the soft wind. And I started playing.
Badalamenti's approach smashed the conventions for how to score a dramatic TV series. Two composers, both creators of well-known TV themes themselves, explain how that happened.
You know, it's like, wow, everything's just so great. Nobody dies. Everyone's happy.
But there is just this little tinge of something. My name is Dave Porter. And I'm a composer for film and television, probably best known for Breaking Bad and its current prequel, Better Call Saul.
Hi, I'm Mark Snow. I am a composer, TV and film. I wrote music for the X-Files. And today we're going to be talking about the great Twin Peaks and especially the marvelous music of Angelo Badalamenti.
The landscape for music and television when I was a teenager, we're talking the 80s, was pretty bleak.
The music for those shows had a certain formulaic approach where I think the composer was not particularly encouraged to get off the reservation too much.
In those days, music was called upon to cover up a lot of other sins. Bad acting, poor writing, and music also had to be made quickly and cheaply. And all those things together put the composer often in a bind.
If I hadn't heard about Twin Peaks or David Lynch or any of this, and I was surfing around on TV and I heard that music, I would think maybe it was like a mild Western almost, hearing that guitar.
He's never in a hurry to do anything. And things are pitched low, but they're also just moseying along at a very deliberate tempo.
I know from experience, directors and producers would always be talking about, we gotta save this scene, it needs more pulse, it can't be too slow, it don't know, it can't repeat like that. We, you know, it's just gotta bang, you know, forward and all that kind of thing. And here's this piece that just kind of sits there.
There is a beauty that I love of using particularly old synthesizers. They weren't always the best at staying exactly in tune. A synthesizer would have a chip or an engine that would play each key, and each key might be slightly off from the next. And there's a little of that in there that I also adore, that has that little bit of darkness.
Why we from the birds sing a freshly song, and there's always music in the air.
I'm not sure which one of them said, hey, let's try this cool jazz for this part, but again, it's a marvelous choice.
It does seem to fit, doesn't it? It defies expectation of why or how it fits, other than the tempo, which is very down, and the overall moodiness of it.
There's still something in common with the kind of repetitive, almost this taffy is, you know, pulling slowly, and this kind of musical goo in a way, and I don't mean that in any derogatory way. Again, it's in the key of C. Now, I know Angelo can write music in a lot of keys, but I think that part of the choice of having all of these pieces we're discussing in the same key of C continues the theme of the moody, hypnotic quality of it.
In my own work, I'm wary of repetition and repeating things exactly the same way for a lot of reasons. For one, people watch shows so differently now, and it's entirely possible that someone would be sitting on the couch and watching 3 hours in a row of the show you're working on. And if you have, you know, a theme X for character X a few times an hour, suddenly you've tripled that, and it can easily become overkill. But that certainly wasn't the case. I mean, we waited an awfully long 7 days to get to the next Twin Peaks that first year.
May I have your attention, please? This is Principal Wolchek. I am deeply saddened to have to tell you that early this morning, your classmate, Laura Palmer, was found dead. This is a terrible moment for all of us. For all of us who knew her.
Still gives me chills. Gives me goosebumps. I love it. It's just a very, very heavy analog synthesizer. And when that super low bass octave comes in, you can feel it in your chest. And then it makes this crazy turn, right? Into the Laura that used to be, as opposed to Laura in the bag on the beach.
It's building, and oh, it's beautiful and more beautiful. And then a climax. Oh, yes, here we are at the top of the beauty.
And now here's a moment where it's big and sweeping.
Almost operatic, actually.
But it's all in contrast to what he set up before.
And then, yeah, we're back to, you know, we're back to the dark world again. It's an A flat major chord with the third on the bass. Actually, in the X-Files theme, the accompaniment figure was exactly those notes, but it was arpeggiated, like... was the same thing. That's Angelo's, and this, and mine is.
Even though these pieces are seemingly disparate, when you hear one, you're instantly transported into that world. Even if you're in another room and you hear it but don't see it, you're going to know that that's what it is. ¶¶
Dave Porter, who composed the music for Breaking Bad and these days is doing so for Better Call Saul and The Blacklist. We also heard from Mark Snow, who was the composer for X-Files and now for the show Blue Bloods. Our piece was produced by Tommy Bazarian and Jocelyn Gonzalez. I've done hundreds of interviews on Studio 360 with established and emerging artists and writers and performers. But we also sometimes like to look at how the work those people make resonates with the people who watch and read and listen to it. How it amuses us, moves us, sometimes even changes us. And also how complicated our relationships can be with something like a painting or movie. Which is why we recently introduced a regular feature called Guilty Pleasures. It's about that thing that you love that would surprise people because it doesn't seem to jibe with your taste or personality, or because it is so unfashionable or unpopular. One of our favorite guilty pleasures so far came from a serious indie rocker.
My name is Kelly Pratt. I'm a musician. I have a band called Bright Moments, and I've played with a number of other artists, including Beirut and Arcade Fire, David Byrne, St. Vincent. My guilty pleasure is the Eagles, Already Gone.
The Eagles suck.
What do you think about the Eagles?
It sucks.
I hate the Eagles. God, do I hate this band.
Eagles suck, bro. Deal with it.
Because I'm already standing on the ground.
People really hate the Eagles. They're like not a cool band to like. First of all, Southern rock is not really that well respected amongst like indie rock people, hip hop people, electronic music folks, you know, classical music, jazz folks. Like it's very popular amongst, you know, a lot of people, but it's not taken seriously.
Well, I'm running down the road trying to loosen my load. I got 7 women on my mind.
Along the same lines, you know, there's a reason people don't like the Eagles so much in a lot of Southern rock. It's because it's so ubiquitous. You hear these songs over and over and over and over again.
Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
And, you know, you can only hear them so many times before you start to hate it. When I gave this song a second chance, I was in the grocery store. Here in Portland, like, a lot of the grocery stores will play Animal Collective and Elliott Smith and cool music. But if you go to the Safeway, they're playing, you know, Eagles.
Well, I heard some people talking just the other day. And they said you were gonna put me on a shelf.
First listen, this song is pretty straightforward. Standard Eagles. It's a guitar-driven rocker, standard breakup lyrics, a lot of patented Eagleisms in here. But when you start to pay attention to it, there's a lot more little fun stuff in there. Aside from the real long guitar solo in the middle of the song, there are a number of real short 1 to 2 bar guitar solos at the end of each little verse phrase. Those are pretty tasteful. There's a couple of them that are quite weird. Almost avant-garde. It's probably interesting to call the Eagles avant-garde in any way. The other thing that really takes this song to the next level for me is after the third or fourth chorus, I believe about 3 minutes and 20 seconds in, there is a modulation, otherwise known as a change of key.
Yes, I'm already gone.
So this is really common in pop music, particularly at the end of a song. Think I Will Always Love You, Whitney Houston. There's a whole step modulation near the end of that song. Golden Lady by Stevie Wonder. The last couple minutes of that song is a continuous series of modulations of a half step up. But this Eagles modulation is an interval of a fourth, which is quite large of a modulation for a pop song. There's one other I can think of, Walk the Line by Johnny Cash. Now that song continually modulates a fourth throughout the whole song and makes it a bit of a gimmick. But in the Eagles song, yes, I'm already gone. It really takes it up a notch and really sends those vocals soaring towards the end for the last couple of choruses. So that's my guilty pleasure, Eagles, Already Gone. Listen and enjoy it afresh.
That was Kelly Pratt, and that piece was produced by Julia Lowry Henderson. So what's a cultural thing you love that's really unexpected or uncool? Tell us about it, and we may feature you on the show. Email us at studio360@pri.org. Still ahead?
Hi, hi, howdy, howdy, hi, hi. Where everyone is minus, you can call me Multiply. Just so you know, yes, yes, I'm that guy. You could get 5 fingers and I'm not waving high. Hey, this is a bird, more like a eagle.
The giddy music of Shamir Bailey, live in Studio 360 from PRI in association with Slate.
Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know.
Studio 360.
This month, we're settling into cool new offices and studios at Slate, so we are playing this month some of our favorite recent Studio 360 segments, this week about music. Like Beyoncé, Shamir Bailey goes by just his first name, Shamir. He's only 22, and in the last 4 years, he's gone from being this high school kid in Las Vegas to somebody the music cognoscenti cannot stop talking about. Shamir's music is a singular concoction of disco and country and rap and more. What ties it all together is his incredible giddy energy and absolutely distinctive voice. Shamir came by our studio to play a few songs off his debut album, Ratchet. He started with a performance of Demon.
The honor roll was all I know till you took me over to the dark side. The thrill was good, together we stood like a modern day Bonnie and Clyde. We'll stay and run, forget the bad things we done. We will fit for survival, no books but the Bible, hold out with a gun. Turning back, yeah, you have me completely. Rich in you, together we flew. Yeah, you're the trap that captured me. And I don't wanna go, don't let my mama know that I'm a ride or die, and it feels so right. And I've gone and sold my soul. It's all a demon, maybe all the beasts that made me. Grow, you're not to blame. I chose to go with you and leave so much shame. If I'm a demon, baby, be always we're on the fast lane. It's you and me together, baby, always we're on the fast lane. It's you and me together, baby, always.
That was Shamir playing the song Demon with Davion Canada on drums, Tiffany Payne on backing vocals, and Danielle McGinley on keyboards and vocals. So you learn to play the guitar at 9 or 10. You perform at a talent show. Then at some point, did you just start playing gigs or did it stay in your bedroom?
No, then I started, like, this is like when I was like trying to do like more like acoustic folk, like country stuff. And I went to like a few honky tonks, did a few country competitions. And
really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Southern Nevada honky tonk country competitions.
Actually,
you must have stood out.
Exactly. It's very off-putting for a lot of people.
Was it interesting for you as a 15 or 16-year-old doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't care. I just wanted to play what I love.
Yeah. And I assume that when you were going to high school in North Las Vegas, you were not like most other kids. Did you find a crowd to hang out with, like the music geeks or the literary people or the theater kids?
Yeah, that was my problem. I couldn't find the crowd. I talked to like the same maybe like three people every day, and like if somehow all three of those people weren't like there at school, I would like sit by myself. But in a weird way, everyone still knew of me because I stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, yeah. But they didn't give you, the horrible version of that would, and they bullied me and they put me in the locker and they beat me up. None of that stuff?
No, people kind of expect that. You know, now that I think back, you know, I was like, I don't know why I didn't get bullied, but I didn't.
Yeah? Maybe Las Vegas is just a paragon of progressivism in America, and it's all about...
I think people don't give it its credit.
Yeah. I think that I've always defended Las Vegas. You tweeted, quote, "To those who keep asking, I have no gender, no sexuality." Really?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I am a type of person that... pretty much my whole life, I'd never felt like tethered to one gender as far as like gender roles.
Right.
You know,
like. But it's not as though you have no sexuality. It's that you have, you're saying you have no specific fixed one.
Exactly.
Oh.
I'm more attracted to someone's personality.
And your parents were cool with this unorthodox child of theirs?
My mom's a Wiccan, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
And do you accept her wickedness?
Sometimes it's hard for me.
Yeah, I can imagine. Was there music that helped you figure out it was okay to be me and all that stuff? Or was this all just an internal mental thing?
I feel like it was something that's always like been instilled in me.
Mm-hmm.
Even like at an early age, just kind of like... you know, going up to my mom and, like, telling her that, like, I don't believe in my religion anymore.
Which religion was that?
I was raised Muslim.
Uh-huh.
I was raised in a Nation of Islam.
Really?
Yeah.
And your mother's a Wiccan?
Yeah. It was, like, one of those...
This is like a TV show.
It was, like, one of those things where, like, once I came out, like, at an early age and was, like, I don't feel comfortable with this. And
yeah.
She kind of realized that it was kind of, you know, forced upon her by her mom. And, and... kind of start to find herself. So I think it was always something like it still me at an early age, but music definitely was like a medium to kind of like help me kind of like do something new, knowing that without all these boundaries.
Right. So I know you have this super cool record label, XL, who have been this super cool record label for years and years and years.
Uber cool.
Exactly. And You signed up to be an intern there even after you'd signed a recording deal with them?
Well, I always wanted to intern at a label, and I got signed. I had to move out here to record the album for 3 months, and I just like needed something to do while I wasn't in a studio. So I was like, can I intern here? I'm like, they can't say no, right? Like, and they didn't. So. I actually interned under my publicist.
Your life is really, I mean, they should make the movie tomorrow. All the scenes in the biopic, or at least in the first act, are here.
Who will play me?
Who should play you?
Zoe Kravitz.
Willow Smith?
Willow Smith can definitely do it.
There you go. Okay, we got two names. And before I let you go entirely, will you play us out with another song?
Yeah.
And what will this one be?
It's called On the Regular.
On the Regular?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Hi, hi, howdy, howdy, hi, hi. Where everyone is minus, you can call me Multiply. Just so you know, yes, yes, I'm that guy. You could get 5 fingers and I'm not waving high. Yes, I'm never ending, you can call me Pie. But really, how long till the world realize? Yep, yep, I'm the best, what you heard. Anything less is...
obviously
absurd. Haters to the bird, more like an eagle. This is my movie, stay tuned for the sequel. Seems so wrong, seems so illegal. Got this in the back like a foul ball free throw. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. I come in with the stick, with the blow, with the boom. And if you're in my way, there's nothing but doom. Ain't got no time for you ratchet ass goons. Just settle down, listen to my tunes. Ever since I was 8, I was attached to the mic. Wanted a guitar before I wanted a bike. Had an Epiphone, like a Fisher Price. Never seen a sound cause I'm up all night. Really, really? Really, really? You wanna talk? But you know that I am illy. Illy to the fullest, you can call me cancer. No multiple choice cause I'm the only answer. Ain't got no wallet, only use for bands. Know my chicken's ratchet cause the bands will make a dance. Wanna get at me? You don't stand a chance. And if you wanna, yes, you can get these hands. Haters get the bird, more like an eagle. This is my movie, stay tuned for the sequel. Seems so wrong, seems so illegal. Got this in the back like a foul ball free throw. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. 5'10", about a buck 20, skinny as a rock, but still won't quit me. Why is that? You think I was 50, but I take it 50 if you take this lift. See? Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. You really feeling it? Here's one more verse, cause I ain't no sushi. Ain't got much to say, cause it's time I peace. Yeah, my words are blunt, and I ain't fucking weed. Ooh, yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know. Yep, yep, you know that I go. This is me on the regular, so you know. This is me on the regular, so you know.
That's Shamir singing On the Regular, and you can see the video of that performance at studio360.org. I talked with Shamir after the release of his first album in 2015. His second one, Hope, was released this spring. And that's it for this week's episode. Studio 360 is produced by PRI, Public Radio International, in association with Slate. Our executive producer is...
Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Our senior editor is...
Andrew Adam Newman.
Our technical director is...
Louis Mitchell.
Our producers are...
Sam Kim.
Skylar Swenson.
Zoe Saunders.
Tommy Bazarian.
And our intern is...
Claude Gallet.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and thank you very much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time on Studio 360, why meeting a favorite writer can be a little disappointing.
I work really hard in all of these books to create a better person on the page than I am in real life.
That wouldn't be hard.
So no, I think that's what writers do. I think we're never better than we are on the page.
Novelist Richard Russo and Jenny Boylan on writing characters and being characters. Next time in Studio 360.